From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Poet and essayist Audre Lorde says, "I work, I love, I rest, I see and learn, and I report." Since the 60s, she's reported from her perspective as a black lesbian feminist. More recently, Lorde's also written about her struggle with cancer. We meet Audre Lorde on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, John Shulian tells us how he went from sports writer to TV writer. Shulian is now executive story editor for Wise Guy and co-wrote the last episode starring Jerry Lewis. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead checks out three new albums that highlight the current New Orleans sounds. And book critic John Leonard reviews Hence by novelist Brad Lighthouser. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Writer Audre Lorde is a black lesbian feminist. She once wrote, "I'm defined as other by every group I'm a part of." Yet she's dedicated much of her life to building bridges between different groups. She has insisted that feminism is relevant to black people and that white feminists need to understand the issues unique to black women. Audre Lorde is a professor of English at Hunter College of the City University of New York, and she's the author of several collections of poems and essays. Her 1980 book, The Cancer Journals, describes her recovery from breast cancer and mastectomy. Her latest collection of essays is titled A Burst of Light. The last piece in this collection is about facing life-threatening illness again, now that she has cancer of the liver. Lorde says that as a young woman, she felt totally alienated, disoriented, crazy. She thought, there's got to be somebody else who feels like I do. By writing very personal autobiographical poems and essays, she has offered affirmation to many black and white, lesbian and straight women. Yet Lorde still often feels like the outsider.
That's both a protection, I think, and sometimes a liability. But I'd rather feel like an outsider and keep my vision clear as to what I want to happen than to feel myself inside and so comfortable that that insider position becomes a mask or a blanket between me and what must be done.
You came of age in the 1950s, and you knew you were a lesbian when you were a teenager. I was wondering how feminism entered the equation, because when you came out, there really wasn't the resurgence of the feminist movement yet.
Well, you know, we have a tendency, I think, in general, to think that we were the first ones who ever felt or thought or believed something if there's been a hiatus, and that isn't true. In the 50s, there certainly were not many of us, there certainly were not many women who spoke in terms of feminism, but I think there were a number of us, most particularly in the downtown lesbian community, which is the community by and large that I moved in once I left my parents' house, who really felt very strongly as women, who in other words were putting into practice in the 50s some of the things that are being looked at now or happened within the second wave of feminism, of course, in the 60s and 70s. There were not many of us, but I would say that we certainly had a pre-feminist consciousness. Mm-hmm. We knew, in other words, that the point of being lesbian was not woman-hating, but was, and it was not, in other words, to become men. It was to express ourselves in terms of how we define womanness.
There was a lot more role-playing in the 50s than there is now. There were a lot of butch mm-hmm. and femme-type bars. Was it hard mm-hmm. to go to gay bars and yet not want to be a part of the butch-femme role-playing?
Was it hard? Well, I guess it was. I guess that's part of what being outside was all about. But it was certainly not harder than being a black woman or being a black lesbian in those days in what was an overwhelmingly white society, which was the lesbian society downtown.
And when you say downtown, you're talking about Greenwich Village in New York.
Yeah, I'm talking about Greenwich Village. Yes, that's right. I'm talking okay. about Greenwich Village, which for me, until many years later, was the only lesbian, gay girl community I knew, mm-hmm. do you see? Because I did not know of black lesbians uptown. Now, I know, I have learned since then that there were clubs, there were groups. I did not have access to them. I did not have access to them at that particular point in my life, which, of course, we can go back to what it means, silence, erasure, isolation. you know, often, Terry, when I say I am a Black lesbian feminist warrior poet, mother doing my work, and people ask me, why do I say that? I say it because, again, if there is one other Black lesbian within sound of my voice, she should know that she is not alone and that it is possible to say that and to survive. Because when I was 15, when I was 13, 14, 15 years old, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. That it was possible to survive?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You once wrote that in the 1950s you thought that Black and white lesbians were about the only Black and white women who were really communicating with each other.
No, what I didn't think of it in those terms in the 50s. What I've said is that looking back on the 50s, I mm-hmm. realized, and I think that this is very true, that we were, in fact, certainly in New York, the only Black and white women who were making attempts to really have relationships with each other, to really talk to each other, even across the very great caverns that, you know, existed between us.
Poet and essayist and activist Audre Lorde is my guest. You faced discrimination in the feminist and lesbian community for being Black, and you faced some discrimination in the Black community for being a lesbian. And I wonder if you've really expected more from both groups, since Blacks and lesbians and feminists have all faced discrimination. Do you know what I mean? Have you been disappointed that they've dished some of it back as well?
No, I can't say that I've been disappointed, Terry, because knowing what I know about how human beings operate, right, and unfortunately, one of the effects of oppression, of any oppression, is not to ennoble us, but to make us very, very parochial. In other words, once difference is used against us so cruelly, we have a tendency to use difference cruelly against other people.
Do you think feminism has had a hard time gaining acceptance in the Black community?
Well, yes, of course, because feminism per se, and I'm speaking now of a movement, has been perceived in many respects correctly so as a white women's movement. This, in fact, is not true. This is why I speak of myself as a Black feminist, and why I say that, of course, Black feminism is not white feminism in blackface. It is a distinct movement created out of the lives and concerns of Black women. When I say that I'm a Black feminist, in other words, I'm saying that I recognize that both my power and my oppressions arise out of my womanness and my Blackness, and that I have a responsibility, as well as absolute survival necessity, to meet them on all of those fronts.
You've been in a long-term relationship with a woman who is white, and I was wondering if there were personal things you had to overcome in keeping the relationship together because of racial differences, or if that's been easy. If it's been hard or easy, and what some of the issues have been, if this isn't too personal, between you that you had to work out because of differences in race.
Francis and I had a relationship, lived together for 19 years as a Black and white woman. We raised my children. We raised two Black children together. What we learned from that relationship, I think, quite obviously has been invaluable to both of us, both in terms of recognizing, say, our own racism, recognizing what was racism and what was not, and how we dealt with it, both together and separately. Francis and I don't all longer live together.
I see.
But we have been, I feel, extremely important in each other's lives.
I know that you were briefly married and you have two children. And if it's not too personal, I was wondering why...
you keep saying if it's not too personal.
Well, you write very personally, so I figure it's okay to ask about these things. On the other hand, I don't want to pry any more than you're comfortable talking about. But, I mean, you knew you were a lesbian when you were pretty young. I was wondering.
Well,
how you ended up
I
married.
Knew I was a lesbian when I was pretty young. I don't know whether I think that that's probably giving me more credit than I really deserve. What I knew was I really, really liked women, loved women, preferred to be in women's company, and I didn't think. I mean, when I was 15 years old, I didn't think the word lesbian. I only discovered the phrase gay girl when I started going down to the village. And that was just about the time I was 15.
Mm-hmm. So when you got married, you thought maybe you really were heterosexual, or?
No, I can't say I ever thought that I was heterosexual, but I can't really say that. You know, Terry, there are some assumptions I think that are operating here that I've seen operating before that don't really feel applicable to me mm-hmm. as I think back in terms of my own feelings. So that it never seemed to me contradictory to have a relationship possibly with a man. When I said I was a lesbian, it's simply that I did not meet a man or men who I would be interested in. Now, I, in fact, had relationships with men during the time that I would say, hey, I'm a gay girl, I'm living in the village, right, so forth, where my primary involvement, my social, political, emotional realities were bound up with women. This didn't stop me from having an occasional relationship with a man.
You raised your two children during most of their childhood with another woman, and you were both out. The children knew that you were lesbians, and you didn't try to hide it from their teachers or from their friends or anything. And you were very clear that you thought it would be best for the children to just be open. And I would like to know why you thought that that was really the best way for them.
Well, let me draw this little scenario for you, Terry. Here we are, a black and a white woman living together in Staten Island. Mm-hmm. Which is the most conservative, reactionary borough of New York, right? And here we are, a black and white woman with two black children, enrolled in a school that is ferociously racist in its tracking, okay? We're on a block where there are black and white families, not too many other children, where the tensions are really beginning to spread from areas that are all white still. Okay? Now, I'm laying that scenario because when you ask me why didn't we counsel the children that it was better to be honest, listen, my kids were beaten up, and the kids who beat them up in the first month, 2 months, 3 months in Staten Island, they didn't yell, your mama's a lesbian. What they yelled was, hey, your mama's a nigger. Now, getting children to understand that what people call you is their problem rather than your problem, but nonetheless that you have to take a position that makes you as powerful as possible meeting their problems, is something that must happen on so many different levels. I've known for myself that I need to be honest because when I'm fighting, I don't need to be fighting myself and my concept of myself as well as people who are trying to either kill me or wipe me out. That's one of the first lessons that it's necessary to teach children. And of course it hurts raising our kids as warriors. But we are, after all, involved in a war. So when you say to me, why was I open with my children about being a lesbian? I had to be open with my children about everything that would empower them in the struggles that they had to face every day. And having lesbian parents was only part of it.
You have a son and a daughter, and I was wondering if having a son made you skeptical of the separatist part of the lesbian feminist movement. For instance, in one of your essays, you write about a conference that you wanted to attend, and this was I forget what the subject of the conference was, but women were advised that they could only take their sons if their sons were under 10. And you wrote a pretty angry mm-hmm. letter in response to that and mm-hmm. basically refused to go to the conference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have to say that I've always been highly suspicious of any kind of separatist politic. Only because, in the last analysis, we need to be able to work together. But since working together or real coalitions requires the coming together of wholes, in other words, we don't come together to fulfill ourselves in each other. We come together to get something done. That means that we must be able to fulfill ourselves, identify ourselves, in other words, develop a sense of who we are. In order to do that, it is easiest or easier to do that by ourselves. So in other words, although I am highly suspicious of separatist politics, I also recognize that it is very frequently absolutely necessary for us to withdraw into ourselves or into the group that we identify as similar in order to get some very, very important work done.
Okay. So you see the need for a time for withdrawing into a certain group, a group
That's
of people
right.
like you, and a time
right.
for joining up with others
exactly.
who aren't like you.
Exactly. So the point that I was making about my 10-year-old son was it is not possible to invite me to a conference where we are going to determine the future of the world and say there is no place in that area for a 10-year-old boy, particularly not for a 10-year-old black boy, because I was not about to subject my son to what was going on in the streets of New York in that particular year. That was the year, I think, that Clifford Glover, the 10-year-old black boy, was shot down in Queens by the New York City police. I was not about to abandon my son to the realities of what life for a black child are in New York and go off to Minnesota to discuss the future of a feminist world. It didn't make sense to me. As a black woman, it didn't make sense to me.
Well, I want to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Audre Lorde, who has written poems and essays about her life and her activism as a black feminist, black lesbian feminist. And we'll talk more about her work after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Audre Lorde, your latest collection of essays is called A Burst of Light. And the last essay in that collection talks about your getting liver cancer. And this was several years after you had cancer of the breast. And your 1980 book, The Cancer Journals, talked about your experiences after your right breast was removed. You made a very interesting and, I think, a very unconventional decision after your right breast was removed. You decided to not get a prosthesis. And I'd like for you to explain those reasons.
Because someone from Reach for Recovery came in with a little prosthesis after I had lost my breast and was really very upset, almost in shock. And she said, "Here, you can be the same as before." And you see, something clicked in my head because I know, no, I am not the same as before. I may be better, I may be worse, I may be different, but I'm not the same. And if you're going to tell me that a piece of artificial fluff stuck in the front of my shirt is going to make me the same, I know it's not. And from that, I had to follow a lot of other things and examine, well, what is going on? And when I really felt the kinds of oppression or the kinds of discrimination that operated against women with cancer, women with breast cancer, I began to make some very vital connections about why women are so afraid to have this operation, what it means to be objectified in society, which are things that I had thought about before, and I put them all together. And I saw the prosthesis for me at that particular point in my life as a mask, as a mummery that I was not going to allow myself or the world to deal with. You dealt with me as who I am, because I need to deal with myself as who I am. And then the question later of whether you wear a prosthesis or not can become either a fashion or a cosmetic one, but not one that defines a woman's identity.
Have you changed your mind about that? Have you since decided to wear a prosthesis?
No, I don't see any reason to, any need to. I mean, for myself personally, and I've never put down women who do wear prostheses, by the way. I really want to make this very clear to you. I do not put down a woman who chooses a different way. I'm only saying that for me, it was emblematic of the kind of objectification that happens with women in the society, and I did not choose to be a part of it.
I guess some people would be concerned that if they didn't wear one, that it would be calling attention to themselves. That it would be getting, do you know what I mean? They would be getting people to look, and then people would have to either pretend like they didn't notice, or they'd have to comment and say something like, oh, did you have breast cancer? Do you know what I mean? That it would kind of force perhaps an uncomfortable conversation.
Oh, but when someone, I come back to the example I gave in the Cancer Journal of Moshe Dayan. When Moshe Dayan wore his patch across his eye because he had lost an eyeball, people didn't come up and commiserate with him about the loss of his eye. They dealt with who he was. They noticed and recognized, yeah, he had been in a war and he had scars, but it was not the topic of every conversation. Well, in the same way, a woman who has had breast cancer is a casualty and a survivor of one of the primary scourges of our time. It's not the only object of conversation, and shouldn't be any more than my eyeglasses are.
Mm-hmm. Have you come across any blame the victim reactions to your cancer? You know that. I think this has been circulating a lot lately, that people get cancer because they're not optimistic enough or because they haven't taken good care of themselves.
Yes, or that we've been too angry. The latest one is, you see, if you weren't so angry, you wouldn't have gotten cancer, which I don't let that stuff bother me too much. Again, because of my perspective as a black woman, having grown up in a society where what's right is white, or certainly what's right is white and male, those accusations don't trouble me because I'm used to being blamed. I'm used to that blame the victim psychology, which says, hey, you know, if you were really who you should be, nothing would happen to you. But of course, and those of us who will grow up black know that that's not true. So the idea of blaming the victim in terms of cancer or in terms of other life-threatening illnesses is a way of avoiding, I think, very often the kinds of fears that we all have about our mortality.
Mm-hmm. Poet and essayist Audre Lorde is my guest. When you were young and starting to write, you bravely sent a poem in for publication. You sent a poem into Ladders, which was the publication of the Daughters of Bilitis, which is a lesbian organization. And they rejected the poem. And I was thinking about how much that must have hurt, because it wasn't like you were even sending it to, like a mainstream magazine where you could have said, well, it's the subject matter that's upsetting them. You know, it was a lesbian publication. What did you do after that? I think for a lot of young writers, it's very difficult to send something off that second time after you've gotten the first rejection.
What did I do? Well, you know, I sent those poems off on the instigation of a friend of mine, a woman who I was living with, the first woman I ever lived with. I didn't think that I was good enough, you see. I didn't think that I was good enough. And when the rejection came back, I was furious and very, very upset. But I thought, oh, well, yeah, I guess I'm not good enough. And it hurt for a long time. It hurt for a long time. It didn't stop me sending out material, but in general, I didn't send very much out at the time anyway, do you see? So it wasn't until I picked up another magazine that I thought I had something to say, or that I wanted to try, or that I read poetry. Because in those earlier years, a lot of the poetry that I was writing was poetry that I had to write, and that did not have too much of an echo in a lot of the things that I was reading or a lot of the things that I saw. So I myself often questioned whether it was poetry or not, but I knew that it affected me and it affected people who were close to me and that I had to do it. So I always had this real question about it, at the same time that I had this dogged determination to go on doing it.
Many of your books have been published by small presses, feminist and gay presses. And I was wondering if that's by choice, if you think that those small presses do a better job than some of the larger publishers do at reaching the audience that you want to reach.
Well, Terry, I feel very committed to small press publishing. To begin with, because I am one of the founding mothers of Kitchen Table Women of Color Press, which is the only press in North America dedicated to the publishing and distribution of works by women of color from various communities that can further our community living and our life as women-identified women. And also because in looking around at what is happening within publishing in this country, I think that small presses hopefully, theoretically, by and large, are keeping some of the most interesting and necessary work alive.
You know,
I also have to say, though, that my experiences with small presses has not been totally unalloyed joy. Okay? So it's a real labor of love to continue working with them.
We only have a little bit of time left. Can I ask you to leave us with a poem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to read a poem for the record, and this poem is dedicated to the memory of Eleanor Bumpers. Remember Eleanor Bumpers, Terry?
Yes, but tell us about her.
Eleanor Bumpers was a 67-year-old black grandmother who lived in public housing in the Bronx. She fell behind her rent 1 month, and the city marshals came to evict her, and they came with two shotguns. And when she refused to let them open, to let them into her apartment, the 67-year-old overweight grandmother, they blew her the lock out with the first shotgun blast, and then they blew her hand away, and then, as the poem says, they killed her. And this poem is dedicated to Eleanor Bumpers because that is a tragedy that affects every single one of our lives and will continue to. For the record, call out the colored girls and the ones who call themselves black and the ones who hate the word nigger and the ones who are merely pale. And who will count the big, fleshy women, the grandmother weighing 22 stone with the rusty braids and a gap-toothed scowl, who wasn't afraid of Armageddon. The first shotgun blast tore her right arm off, the one with the butcher knife. The second blew out her heart through the back of her chest, and I am going to keep writing it down. How they carried her body out of that house, dress torn up around her waist, uncovered, past tenements and the neighborhood children, a mountain of black woman. And I am going to keep telling this if it kills me, and it might, in ways I am learning. The next day, Indira Gandhi was shot down in her garden. And I wonder, what are these two 67-year-old colored girls saying to each other now? Planning their return, and they weren't even sisters.
Audre Lorde, thank you very much for reading that poem and for joining us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
And the poem Audre Lorde just read is published in her collection, Our Dead Behind Us. Her latest collection of essays is called A Burst of Light. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Jane Kramer. Since 1978, she's written the New Yorker feature, Letter from Europe. Her new book, Europeans, is a collection of her pieces about Europe. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When John Shulian decided he wanted to quit sports writing and try his hand at writing for TV, he sent some of his work to Stephen Bochco. Since then, John Shulian's written for L.A. Law, Slap Maxwell, and Wise Guy. Coming up, Shulian tells us about making the change. New Orleans is known for its jazz tradition, but jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews three albums that show some of the contemporary jazz coming out of the city. And book critic John Leonard reviews Brad Lighthouser's new novel, Hence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The 101st Congress convened today as the new members of the Senate and all the House of Representatives took the oath of office. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
The meeting of the first Congress 200 years ago was much on the minds of the House as members looked to the session ahead. In celebrating this bicentennial, the leaders of both parties called for bipartisanship. Republican leader Robert Michael particularly wants the commitment of the Democratic leadership to revise the ethical code for House members. Democratic Speaker Jim Wright pledged that cooperation, saying that he and Michael would soon name a bipartisan task force to study the standards of conduct. House members are keenly aware that the few incumbents who lost their seats in November had ethical taints raised as issues in their campaigns. Because so few incumbents were defeated, the Republican leader, tired of serving in the minority, would also like to see a change in the way campaigns are financed. Those issues are likely to turn into bitter battles as the Congress gets down to business, but today it was one of putting problems aside as members celebrated the spirit of cooperation and bipartisanship. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Lawyers for Oliver North have subpoenaed Secretary of State Shultz, former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger, and former White House Chief of Staff Donald Regan. North, who goes on trial January 31st, is charged with diverting money from Iranian arms sales to the Contras in Nicaragua. His attorneys have also subpoenaed President Reagan and President-elect Bush. Former Democratic presidential candidate Michael Dukakis said today he won't run for re-election when his term expires as Massachusetts governor. Details from Deborah Roby in Boston.
In announcing that he will not be a candidate for a fourth term in Massachusetts, Governor Michael Dukakis was asked the obvious question, will he make another try for the White House in 1992?
I've learned occasionally painfully just never to say never in politics, but this decision is totally independent of any considerations of another try at national office.
Dukakis, who first became governor 13 years ago, is facing the next 2 years as a lame duck with a huge budget deficit estimated at more than $500 million. Many of his opponents say his announcement this early clears the way for others who want to seek his job, but also gives him the freedom to close the shortfall by taking an unpopular route, raising taxes in Massachusetts. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Roby in Boston.
The White House announced today that President Reagan will undergo surgery on his hand. The operation is scheduled for Saturday. We get details from NPR's Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The president has a degenerative condition of connective tissue in his hand called Dupuytren's contracture, and it's causing the ring finger on his left hand to contract uncontrollably. According to White House physician Colonel John Hutton, the president will enter Walter Reed Army Hospital on Friday, and the operation will take place Saturday morning. The procedure will be performed under local anesthetic and take 2 to 3 hours. The president should be ambulatory by afternoon and back on the job on Sunday. Hutton said that Mr. Reagan has suffered from this condition since he entered the White House in 1981, but it became worse in the past year. In Los Angeles, I'm Ina Jaffe reporting.
In China, the outbreak of anti-African protests spread to the capital today as about 200 Chinese students demonstrated outside of Beijing College. They were demanding punishment for an African student involved in a weekend incident that injured a young Chinese woman. The 3-hour demonstration was not directly linked to a week of anti-African racial unrest among students in eastern Nanjing, but foreigners at the Beijing campus said tensions were apparently heightened by recent incidents in other cities. Wall Street closed lower in the first session of 1989, but managed to recover somewhat from an earlier loss. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended down almost 24 points, finishing the day at 2144.64. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Anyone who's visited New Orleans knows there's a lot more to its music scene than jazz funerals and Dixieland bands. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead has a review of a 3-volume anthology that illustrates the diverse styles of new jazz from the city. From the new New Orleans music, here's a bit of Newfound Love by the Improvisational Arts Quintet.
In a country where regional differences have been eroded by television, New Orleans retains genuine local flavor. Growing up closer to the Caribbean than to most of the U.S., New Orleans musicians developed a local accent, a syncopated lope close to the mambo or rumba. Think of the music of Fats Domino or Professor Longhair, and you'll hear what I mean. But while record companies are happy to sign up musicians who are from there, from Louis Armstrong to Wynton Marsalis, New Orleans homebodies don't often turn up on record. Now, a series of 3 albums produced by Kalamu Yassalam for the Rounder label, called The New New Orleans Music, documents the work of 6 local bands or artists who've recorded either Not at All or Not Enough. 1 volume's devoted to singers Joanne Creighton, a.k.a. Lady BJ, and Jermaine Basil. You can hear that hometown rhythm on Basil's version of the old Doris Day hit, Secret Love.
Once I had a secret love that lived within the heart of me. All too soon, my secret love became impatient to be free.
New Orleans musicians impose their local accent on any music. One of the ways jazz got started there was by loosening up existing songs. The 4-piece New Orleans saxophone ensemble, led by tenor man Tony DeGrotti, blends the plush chords of the World Saxophone Quartet with the punch of a rhythm and blues horn section. Here's a little of DeGrotti's tune, Gemini Rising. Earl Turbinton Jr. plays soprano. New Orleans may be famous for great music, but players there still have to scuffle to make a living. Successful musicians may play parade, carnival, and lounge music, and Dixieland, as well as modern jazz and R&B. As a result, few New Orleans players are purists. They hear music as a continuum, one genre spilling over into another. On pianist Ed Frank's tune, A Corn for Crip, played by his quintet, Irving Charles's bass part sounds lifted from a parade tuba. Wendell Brunius plays trumpet. The drum syncopations are by Joseph Smokey Johnson.
Thank you.
On the same album, bassist Ramsey McLean's party band, The Survivors, do a silly but hip cover of bandleader Sun Ra's tune, Rocket No. 9. They underline the parallels between Ra's cosmic concerts and the spectacle of Mardi Gras. Charmaine Neville of the Neville family is on vocals. Since these sessions were recorded between 1985 and 87, a number of the musicians included here have left the hometown scene for more lucrative work elsewhere. No matter how many good musicians leave New Orleans, the city never runs out of them. But that perpetual exodus also means that these valuable samplers of New Orleans music document a time that's already passed.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the New Orleans Music, a 3-volume anthology on the Rounder label. Here's some more of Lady BJ with Ellis Marsalis' quartet. This is Fresh Air. You may remember John Shulian as the first sports commentator on Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. He left Weekend Edition and his job as a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News in 1986 to write for television. He says he's been having a great time. He's written for L.A. Law, Miami Vice, Slap Maxwell, and now he writes for Wise Guy. We wanted to know what the transition has been like, so we invited John Shulian to the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles and asked him why he gave up sports writing in the first place.
Basically, I was tired of talking to naked men. I had been in newspapers for, starting in 1970 when I got out of the Army. And I had, done 5 years in Baltimore and a year and a half in Washington and, 7 years in Chicago. And then I went to Philadelphia late in 1984. And I'd only been there for about 3 or 4 months, and I guess it was having to write about Moses Malone on my 40th birthday that sort of that brought me to the realization that I just didn't want to do this for another 20 or 25 years.
Had you had one too many sports metaphors you had to write?
Oh, writing it was still fun. That was the one thing that I took pleasure in, was sitting down and writing, but I did not like getting on airplanes or living in hotel rooms for basically 6 or 7 months out of a year. Didn't like going to the ball games. Didn't like talking to many of the athletes. And I just knew I had to get out of the business. I think sports writing is a very difficult business in which to age gracefully. I think too many sports writers find themselves at 50 sitting in a press box making fun of ball players who have speech impediments.
What did you want to write for television?
Well, basically, when I came to the decision that I wanted to get out of newspapers and sports writing, I just wanted to write. I mean, it's the only skill I have. I can't sell you a pair of shoes, and I sure can't pound a nail in straight. And I just wanted to find another area to go to where I could still write and make a living. It just seemed like a logical thing to do, basically. I think there were a number of people who were jumping from one form of journalism or another and coming out here, and I just decided to follow in their path.
What was your first big break?
My first big break was writing a letter to Stephen Bochco. Just before I was to leave for Wimbledon in 1985, and I sent Stephen a copy of a book I'd done, a collection of my boxing pieces called Writers, Fighters, and Other Sweet Scientists, which is now available at some used bookstores, and a couple magazine pieces I had done. And I just said that I would like to try this, and would he be interested in you know, taking a look at my work and me? You know, he wrote me back, and he said, he wrote me back very quickly, quicker than anybody in newspapers or magazines ever did, and said, there are a lot of journalists who think they can do this, and there are a lot of journalists who can't, but if you're still interested, I'll send you some Hill Street scripts, just let me know, and in the meantime, I'll read your book. So now I came back from Wimbledon, found this letter, immediately wrote him, and said, you know, please send the Hill Street scripts. So then I went on 2 weeks vacation, came back from that, and here were the Hill Street scripts and a letter from Stephen saying that he'd read about half my book so far and that he loved it and that he would be surprised and disappointed if I couldn't make a go of it in Hollywood, and that as soon as he got his show about lawyers off the ground, he was going to have me come out and write a script for money. And 1 year later, in June of 1986, he was good to his word, and I was out here writing the 8th episode of L.A. Law.
So which was the episode you wrote?
It was one about a bag lady named Crazy Katie and a trust fund for the poor people of Beverly Hills. And I guarantee you that there was not, even though I got sole writing credit on the thing, that there was not that much Shulian in there, because wisdom prevailed, and Stephen and Terry Fisher and Jacob Epstein and all the others who worked on the show really pitched in and helped me an awful lot.
Now, you're the story editor for the series Wise Guy now. What does it mean to be the story editor?
I'm executive story editor,
which, again,
get that straight. That's just a glorified title for a writer. I mean, We're all writers. You know, you can be a staff writer, story editor, executive script consultant, co-producer, producer, supervising producer, co-executive producer, executive producer. They can all be writers.
You co-wrote the second episode in the Wise Guy arc, and arc means, in Wise Guy language, arc is a series of stories.
Right, a group of episodes.
A group of episodes, right.
4, 5, 7, 9, as many as 9. We like to think it gives the show a Dickensian quality.
So this is the arc with Jerry Lewis starring as someone who runs a business in the garment. In the garment industry.
Eli Sternberg, a big mocker in the garment district.
There's an interesting scene at a banquet testimonial, and Lewis asked to make a speech, and what he does is accuse the guest of honor of basically extortion and blackmail.
Right.
It must have been a lot of fun to write that, because you were working so against type with Jerry Lewis, who on TV, usually when he's making speeches, it's about what a great humanitarian somebody is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, that's the joy of the show, I think, is that, you know, we fly in the face of a lot of things that, you know, we just don't do things the way people expect them to be. We don't have, we have actors playing against type.
This is a crime series, so obviously there's violence in it. What kind of standards do you have to take into account when writing the beatings and the shootings for the series?
Well, funny you should ask. I mean, the first show I wrote for Wise Guy was the concluding episode of our first arc, which was about white supremacists. And Steve Cannell, who's the lord and master of the whole operation over there, walked out of the first cut screening we had of it and said it was the most violent show he'd ever been associated with in 20-odd years of television. And this is a man who's, you know, killed conservatively probably 1 million people on television. he's given us the A-Team and Beretta and the Rockford Files and, you know, just so many wonderful TV shows. But, you know, it's not It's a show, really, that concentrates much more on emotional violence. We don't have car chases. We don't have gun battles. I don't think we've had a... I'm trying to think. I can only think of one scene in which Vinny Terranova has had a gun in his hand this season. In the episode I wrote, I really wanted to show how random and spooky violence is. And we had three racist nuts break into a civil rights leader's home. And one of them, and he's sitting, and the civil rights leader was sitting down to dinner with his wife and kids. And one of the bad guys started yelling, don't hurt the woman and kids. And the leader of the bad guys turned on his running mate and shot him.
That's a pretty scary moment because you realize this guy's totally out of control. He's going to shoot his own man.
Exactly. And I mean, and I think that gives the show a lot of its edgy quality. And that's really something we strive for.
So now I suppose you'll want to write movies next, huh?
Actually,
yes.
I have one screenplay that I wrote on spec during the strike. It's a boxing movie. It's gotten some nice feedback, but not enough to convince anybody to buy it. And I'm presently reworking it with what little spare time I have. And then a couple other movie projects, one about a gambler and the other about Red Smith, who was probably the greatest sports writer of all time.
Okay, well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. Thanks.
My pleasure.
John Chulian is now the executive story editor for the TV series Wise Guy, which is usually on Wednesdays on CBS, but it's preempted this week. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, I take it Washington is back in business?
Absolutely. The new Congress is in town today. And they're not likely to accomplish very much, but they do restore the Capitol to its usual feverish level of activity. We'll have reports from Cokie Roberts and Linda Wertheimer about the legislators being back in town. We will also hear about what the town of El Segundo, California, right next to the airport in Los Angeles, is doing about airplanes that keep turning prematurely and turning over their town. We'll hear about the 100 best movies, according to somebody who has ranked them, and about the Alaska Pipeline Revisited, not apparently as much environmental damage as was feared.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Hence is a new novel by Brad Lighthouser. His earlier novel was called Equal Distance, and he's also published two books of poetry. Lighthouser's work often shows up on the pages of The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, and The Atlantic. Book critic John Leonard says Lighthouser was ambitious with his new novel.
Hence, stripped of the paraphernalia of modernism in which it's wrapped, could have been an old-fashioned story about people who feel bad. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, in 1993... a boy named Tim feels bad because he's losing at chess to a computer named Andy. Tim's mother, Doris, feels bad because she's lost her husband and her breasts. Tim's brother, Garner, feels bad because that's his profession. He's a philosopher. Tim's favorite TV evangelist, Reverend Rabbit, feels bad because he's stabbed himself on camera with a jackknife. And Tim's principal competitor for media attention, a Japanese musical prodigy, feels bad because the Haydn-like symphonies he composes are 200 years too late. All these people are full of interesting, even furious grievance, including Andy, an MIT proto-mind. They've something to say, but Brad Lighthouser refuses to let them say it simply. Lighthouser, a fine poet who writes difficult fiction, has too much on his mind for the good of his characters. He broods about the disintegration of American family life, the loss of faith in the modern world, the end of literature as we know it, human sacrifice, and artificial intelligence. He's especially disdainful of that Benthamite utilitarianism from which our secular society so joylessly derives. He can't stop himself from digressing on twins and junk food and Icelandic sagas. And he seems to have submitted his manuscript for prior approval to those mandarins of the Academy who insist on the latest in French theories about structure and subtext. Thus, the meat of Hence is sandwiched between leaves of diffident preface and macrocosmic aftermatter. The book we are about to read, the book we have finished reading, is looked back on from a future in which there are no books. A fictitious editor deems it to have been prophetic of a time to come after something called the shift, perhaps from man to machine. It is called a meditation instead of a novel. It is a performance pointing at itself. Instead of caring about Tim or Doris or the Reverend Rabbit or the shamefully neglected Japanese musical prodigy, we end up admiring Lighthouser's Nabokovian cleverness, the imp of Calvino in him, his Stanislaw Lemming-like way with androids and androgyny, his hounding of God in the random access of an Updike. Hence, in fact, reminds me more of Updike's Rogers version than any other recent novel. It too much enjoys its own proofs, its winks and nudges and theological bullying. Like Tim's philosopher brother, we're supposed to grow up out of our disappointment by the universe, to shake off our feeling that life itself is a raw deal, to arrive at some unspecified vantage point or launching pad from which we may go hence, may actually get somewhere. According to the novelist, trapped as we are in systems, quote, capacious enough to encompass the very paradox of self-reference, what everybody who feels bad is really saying is, I want out. And everybody is also saying, give me a voice. And yet this specific novel, this witty Hence, is also a closed system of paradox and self-reference. And from it we want out, because nobody has a voice.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Hence by Brad Lighthouser. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Eric Bogosian talks about bringing his show Talk Radio to the screen. Bogosian stars as a two-way talk show host who goads and insults his callers. Talk Radio is directed by Oliver Stone. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of an early recording of Ravel's Bolero in honor of that work's 60th anniversary. And Ken Tucker looks at some vintage movies, back again thanks to home video. So I hope you can join us, and we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WEMU in Ypsilanti, Michigan. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.